You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 24th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Chair of the History Department at UC Davis, Catherine Olmsted, on her book, Right Out of California, 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. Meanwhile, Turkey shoots down a Russian fighter jet. What happens next? We don't really know. And moments ago, it was announced that Chicago prosecutors will charge a cop with first-degree murder in the shooting 16 times Laquan McDonald. Just a day before video footage, or I should say just hours before video footage from the cop's dash cam is forced to be released by a judge. Meanwhile, in Minnesota, protesters who were protesting the shooting, the fatal shooting of Jamar Clark, five of them were shot by apparently white supremacists who showed up at the protests. Meanwhile, as if to explain it all, white Christians are no longer a majority in this country. Yet, they still represent a majority of voters in the Republican Party. Folks, you do the math. That's a problem for them. And meanwhile, Ben Carson reverses, Donald Trump cruises, and Cruz surges. And Steve Beshear, on the way out of the governorship in Kentucky, reinstates the voting rights of a huge segment of the a significant segment of the Kentucky population. And latest polling show, Americans want more war. And also exciting, in Maine, we may see statewide ranked choice voting, which would, if it actually was to spread beyond Maine, would end up perhaps, eliminating a huge portion of our discussions on this program in the run-up to elections. I mean, that would be, it would be devastating. It would be almost as if like a bus hit all libertarians and they were no longer to use the phone or something. That it would have that type of impact on our program. I will talk more about this ranked voting. It's fascinating, and it really would be exciting if that was to catch on. We do not have video at the moment. For those of you who are listening to the audio stream or have gone to the video page and found that we didn't have video, isn't that right, Kelly? Okay, Kelly's so angry about it, she can't even talk. And but you're efforting it, as they say in the business, right? Well, that's fine, because this interview is one which I actually did with Catherine Olmsted. Would you want to say something on the microphone? Don't be shy.
It's going to work.
Okay, there you go. That's like from the engineering department. It's like when Captain Kirk calls down to Scotty. You had far more confidence than Scotty did. We recorded this interview about a week and a half ago, I believe it was, with Catherine Olmsted, I should say, on her book Right Out of California, 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. It was the same week that we had interviewed Edward Miller on his book Nut Country about essentially what we now know as the Southern strategy and how it came out of Texas. And so we make reference in the story to that. Then we'll come back. We're going to keep it tight in the fun half today, knock on wood. And this will be the last live show before Thanksgiving. Now, Thanksgiving is only 2 days away. Tomorrow, we have an interview that I did with Charlie Savage from the other day on his new book, Power Wars. It's fascinating stuff. He is obviously a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter, an incredible reporter, and has done some great work. And we have that interview for you tomorrow. Thursday, we will be off for everyone. So go eat some turkey, argue with your family. If you have to and you're able to drink, I would recommend that. If you're not able to drink, then I would just maybe bury yourself in a past Majority Report episode, maybe re-listen to the Janine episode again. That could be fun for you. Or maybe go back, listen to Andy Kindler. That's always fun. Hear someone more agitated than yourself at any given time. And then on Friday, we will have a members-only show, which will include... And I have made this decision unbeknownst to her. She's never bugged me about it. It's weird. We will have an interview that my 10-year-old daughter, did with David Cross. Now, there's a video of it. We're not going to put that out. I don't think I have to wait on that. But there is an audio interview where Mila interviews David Cross on more or less his role in Pitch Perfect 2. And it was... how it came about, well, I'll tell this on the member show, exactly how it came about. But it was very generous of David to sit down with Mila, particularly since, you know, Mila does not have the reach and the power that she used to have, frankly, as a broadcaster. And so this was definitely a favor for her, and hopefully will revive her career. So that will be there for members. And also, I think we're going to include either something from Dilip Hero, maybe a time that Bernie Sanders was on the program. And we'll also include something else, I think, for members probably on Wednesday as well, or it could just be a Charlie Savage interview. Okay, but in the meantime, we're going to take a very brief break and then come back with Catherine Olmsted. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Catherine Olmsted. She is a professor of history at UC Davis and the author of Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. Catherine, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
We've started this week has been a little bit of an ad hoc a theme about the birth of modern conservatism. And we spoke the other day with Edward Miller, who has written a book tracking the birth of the Southern strategy to Texas. And you've written a book that tracks a not exclusive, but a different strain of what we see in modern conservatism today, that emanated out of California in the early 30s, or I should say in the 1930s. And it's fascinating in many respects because we have today, right now as we speak, with Ben Carson and Donald Trump leading the polls in the Republican primary, almost a perfect manifestation, not quite perfect, but fairly close as to sort of the modern conservative movement. And in some ways, we can track this all the way back to the early last century.
Yes. I mean, it's hard to put an exact start date for the modern conservative movement. Certainly, you could say that it goes back to the 19th century. But I would argue that really you start seeing what we call, or that we would recognize as the new right in the 1930s because of big businessmen's opposition to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal.
And let's talk about this. So this comes out of California. Why this opposition, I think, was certainly dispersed throughout the country in terms of big businesses. Yes, what was it about California that was different?
Well, California's largest industry at that time was agriculture, agribusiness. And agribusiness in California, farming in California, was very different than farming in the rest of the United States, partly because of the legacy of the Spanish period when there had been these large land grants for very wealthy individuals, and partly because of the need for irrigation projects that take a lot of capital. California's farmers, on average, tended to be much wealthier, have much bigger properties than farmers in the rest of the country. And you also have in California a lot of corporate farmers. So the biggest landowners in California are the Southern Pacific Railroad and the Standard Oil Company and Bank of America, all of which invest in agribusiness. So there's this pattern in California of having these very large corporate farms that where the crops are picked by waves of different immigrants. And by the 1930s, it's largely Mexican immigrants as well as Okies coming from the southwestern United States. And they're paid very little money, and they have almost no relationship with the landowner. There's all sorts of middlemen between them and the people that own the land. And as a result, there were lots of very desperate people in the California fields in the 1930s that were beginning to form unions because of Franklin Roosevelt's pro-union policies.
And I mean, I guess the irony, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves because in some way I want to sort of talk about the broader context in which this is happening. But one of the ironies is that farm workers, and we've talked to people in the past about how there were various aspects of the New Deal that sort of codified a certain amount of racism and certain classes of workers, but it really is a function of jobs and I guess industries which were where there was a high incidence of African Americans or other minorities working, were left out of the New Deal specifically as a means in which to get a lot of these things passed, broadly speaking, and run around the Southern Democrats at the time. So when we're talking about agriculture, in many respects, that industry was impacted by the New Deal less than any other industry.
Right. The labor laws, Roosevelt's labor laws, actually didn't apply to agriculture because, as you say, he had made this deal with the devil, this Faustian bargain with Southern Democrats, and exempted domestic workers and farm workers from Social Security as well as all of his labor laws. So farm workers had no collective bargaining rights, no minimum wage, and no Social Security at the beginning. So they were left out of the New Deal, but they didn't know that. And so once they started, you know, hearing about Roosevelt's labor laws and saw this wave of strikes across the country in factories and on wharves and in the cities, they decided that they would start organizing as well. And the agribusiness titans of California were furious about this. And directly laid it at Roosevelt's feet, even though Roosevelt had not done anything for the farm workers.
So wait, so when you say they didn't know this, like they didn't, they literally didn't know it, and so they thought they were striking under the auspices of some law that it was protecting them, or was it that they were empowered by the idea of other people getting a certain protections?
Well, you know, certainly the latter part is definitely true, that they were empowered by the example of industrial workers. But beyond that, there is a lot of documentary evidence from Labor Department officials at the time that the workers literally did not know that they were not covered by the National Industrial Recovery Act in 1933. And in fact, you know, there was some ambiguity at the very beginning because the law did not expressly state that agricultural workers were exempted. It just came to be interpreted that way very quickly. So farm workers believed that they were covered. They believed that Franklin Roosevelt wanted them to join a union, and so they started joining these strikes. And they have the biggest farm worker strikes in American history in the 1930s in California. Up to 50,000 workers struck in California, field workers struck in California in 1933 alone, and there's one big cotton strike where there's 18,000 workers that go on strike. By contrast, Cesar Chavez's strikes were 2,000-3,000 farm workers.
And so what were the protections that they thought that they had? Did they thought that they had the ability to unionize easier or, I mean, legally as opposed to what they actually had? I mean, what specifically did they think that they had that they didn't?
Well, they thought that they had the right to demand that employers recognize their union if a majority of them supported a union, and that they thought they had the right to protection from unfair labor practices, like getting fired simply because they signed a union card. And in fact, those are the protections that industrial workers just gained in 1933. And, you know, they weren't enforced that well, even for industrial workers, which is why Senator Wagner passed his National Labor Relations Act, wrote, and Congress passed his National Labor Relations Act in 1935. But there were these significant improvements for union rights in 1933, and farm workers thought they were part of that.
And so what, I mean, at what point do they realize they're not? And how did that play out?
Well, you know, I would say by early 1934. So there's only about a 6-month period here when you have farm workers going out on these massive strikes, thinking they're protected by the federal government. So it's a rather short period, but it is long enough for the growers in California to decide that the Franklin Roosevelt administration is not on their side and that there's something about his brand of social democracy which is fundamentally threatening to their control over their workforce. And again, this is a bit of an irony because the growers get a lot from the New Deal. They get dams and canals and roads and agricultural subsidies, millions of dollars in agricultural subsidies, and all of which they're very much in favor of. Yet despite all of these benefits they're getting from the New Deal, they're frightened by the empowerment of workers.
Well, I mean, I guess it's not as much of a paradox when you just look at it as like they just want what they want, and that it's not that ideological purity is not really the name of the game. We can be statist over here if it benefits us, and we're not statist over there if it doesn't benefit us. I mean, how was it though? What fascinates me is that obviously they can't directly blame Roosevelt and the New Deal because the New Deal specifically leaves their workers behind. But they see this as a just sort of a rising threat in the country. I mean, that, you know, this idea that now the establishment is on the side, just very generically speaking, on the side of labor is that's the threat they're responding to.
Right. And I wouldn't even say, you know, you say they can't blame Roosevelt, but in fact, they do. And even in the next year, 1934, Upton Sinclair runs for governor of California, gets the Democratic nomination. Roosevelt refuses to endorse him. And in fact, the establishment Democratic Party in California cuts Sinclair off, their own nominee, near the end, because they're so frightened by Sinclair's socialist ideas. But even though the establishment Democrats and the Democratic president do not help the socialist Democratic candidate in California, again, big business blames the National Democratic Party, blames Franklin Roosevelt for creating an environment in which someone like Upton Sinclair could get the Democratic nomination, could get a lot of attention and potentially power to implement his ideas about redistributing wealth. And so they no matter what Roosevelt does to distance himself from, dismiss, marginalize the left, he gets blamed by the right for creating this, for empowering the left.
And so does the response here, does it focus on, do they simply become, I guess, enemies, maybe that's too strong of a word, maybe it's not, of FDR's, or do they begin to create a programmatic response to what they see has been unleashed in society?
Well, yes, they're very organized. They get organized by the fall of 1933. Agribusiness in California specifically forms a group called the Associated Farmers, which is a little bit of a switch for them, because California growers for a long time had rejected the word farmer and said, you know, we're not farmers, we're businessmen, we create a product to sell. But by 1933, they realized the power, the propaganda power of using, of calling themselves farmers and attaching themselves to that image. So they form this group, the Associated Farmers, and it's funded by the largest landowners and shippers and canners in California, and they start raising lots of money, first of all to defeat the farm worker unions, but then to use against any political candidates that they believe are too pro-union.
Interesting. And so why though just California? I mean, what is unique about California that this is happening? I mean, because presumably, right, there are other industries. I mean, this is developing. What was it about California that was unique?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is that you have this landholding pattern that's different, so that you have all of these corporate farmers. You also have a very precarious industry. Because the growers are producing food, which can obviously spoil, where the prices are so volatile, and where you're uniquely vulnerable to a strike, because even like a two-week strike might be long enough to ruin your crop. Because it's so precarious, they are particularly determined to control their workforce, to control their labor costs, and to make sure there's no unions. So they are among the most anti-union businessmen in the United States.
That's fascinating, because I've never really contemplated that paradox, which is that the people in the fields are probably amongst the most alienated, the least sort of represented in some respects throughout society, and people you would imagine have the least amount of political power throughout, you know, our entire society as a class. Yet, because of the nature of the work, they have perhaps the most power as in terms of withholding their labor.
Right, and that is what truly terrifies the growers.
And they begin this program. I mean, how much of this has to do, too, with racism? I mean, we're talking about Mexicans here, and there's some reference that, you know, we hear where people are saying, you know, You're handing this over to communists and aliens and whatnot. But how much of this is racism, or does the racism really just function on the level of the expectations of the farmers, or I should say the agribusiness guys, over, you know, how they perceive the value of these lives that are actually, you know, functioning for them in the fields?
Well, I think that, you know, it's not an either or answer. I think that racism is a part of this and is sort of woven into the fabric of agribusiness and agribusiness labor relations in California. So for years, for decades, the growers had depended on waves of immigrants. There were Chinese and then Japanese and then Filipinos and then Mexicans who were coming into California and picking the crops. And so this makes it very easy for the growers to control the workers. And also because they're the recent immigrants, or maybe even they're undocumented and they speak different languages, and they're desperately poor. And also because they have darker skin, then the growers can see them as different from themselves. And also the voters of California can see them as different from themselves and be less compelled to intervene to help them. And by the 1930s, the biggest group in the California fields in the early 30s are Mexican Americans, and then those are increasingly joined by the Okies. And as the labor force whitens, then there becomes much more interest among the people who in California who vote in the conditions in the field.
And what happens then as that dynamic takes place? I mean, so if I hear you correctly, this is a sort of a capitalist versus labor fight where race is simply is primarily a sort of an arrow in the quiver of the capitalists, as opposed to sort of the organizing principle. So what happens when that workforce becomes more white as I guess the Depression sets in?
Well, by the late 30s, it looks like that the increasing number of Anglos in the field might lead to some actual reforms for California labor. But because there's John Steinbeck writing the novels about the Jodes and other Anglo workers who are portrayed very nobly, you have Dorothea Lange's photographs. And then at the very end of the 1930s, there's actually a Senate investigation into unfair labor practices in California fields. And all of those things make reformers hope that something is going to change, that suddenly there's a lot of attention on the California fields. There's also a nonfiction book by Carrie McWilliams, Factories in the Fields, that gets a lot of attention. But then comes World War II. And with World War II, the Okies, in large measure, leave the fields and go to the shipyards where they can earn a whole lot more money. And once again, you have Mexican Americans picking the crops, and that interest that was there, that historical moment, is over.
And so what is happening? So that's on the sort of the labor side. And so what are they building? What are these sort of agribusiness titans? What are they building in terms of a movement? I mean, how do they go about? What are the ideological foundations from which they build upon? And how do they begin to sort of, I guess, export that across the country?
Well, they begin to form organizations of big businessmen that get together to think about how to best spend their money to get ideological candidates who agree with them ideologically. And they also start using political consultants. The first political consultants in America are in Sacramento in 1933. And these are people who don't just come up with slogans, who don't just do the ads and write speeches, but they plan the whole campaign. They come up with themes, as well as all of the organization and the ads and the speeches. And the political consultants are, you know, a major change for American politics, because it becomes much more driven by what the backers decide the voters want. You know, they do a lot of polling to decide, okay, how can we get our person elected, and then they make their candidate into what the voters want.
Interesting. And to what extent does the church play any role, or any, I should say, I guess, religion? Because my sense is that there was also sort of a healthy dose of Christian conservatism that was sort of commingling here, particularly sort of like, I guess, theologies about money in some respect.
Yes. And this is what I was surprised to find in my research, because, of course, we think of this with the 1970s, or maybe at the earliest the 1960s, these Christian conservatives aligning with corporate conservatives to form a modern Republican movement. But in California in the 1930s, you already see this alliance beginning, with a lot of conservative Christian pastors being approached and recruited by corporate conservatives and saying, we have a common interest here, even though you might be populist on economic issues and we're quite conservative on economic issues, we can all agree that there's a cultural threat that the Roosevelt administration and unions are making our society more secular, less godlike, less godly, and encouraging women to work outside the home and encouraging racial diversity and all of these trends that we find frightening.
Interesting. And so, I mean, give us a sense of like what, if, I mean, I guess, you know, we touched on Steinbeck, but one of the aspects of your book that was, I think, sort of was telling too, is that there was really not much of a record for what was going on in the labor movement at that time, and that even as Steinbeck, you know, presumably recounts it, he's recounting when that wave of Okies come in and sort of disregarding the role of non-whites and of non-male probably in those early 30s. I mean, is that a fair statement on my part?
Yes, definitely. The actual strikes in California, farm worker strikes in the 1930s, were very racially diverse, with Filipinos and Mexican Americans and African Americans and even some Indian and Chinese and Japanese immigrants all joining together with the Okies in these strikes. There's also a lot of women who are participating, because women pick the crops alongside the men in order to feed their families. And there's women leaders of the strikes. And Steinbeck wrote his first great dramatic novel in Dubious Battle about a specific strike and two specific leaders of the strike. One of them was a woman, and he changed her into a man in telling his version of the story.
Let me ask you this. I mean, as long as we're talking about sort of like, you know, broader context as well, I mean, give us a sense of just how diverse. I mean, I know that the when it came to farm workers, they were organized almost exclusively by self-identified communists at the time, because I mean, I guess I'll pose that question to you. Why was it that they were being organized only under a communist rubric? And sort of beyond that, give us a broader sense of the political context in which this blowback, or I guess I should say pushback by big business takes place. Because one of the things that I think is sort of that is interesting when you compare that era with our era is that we have a much narrower political context, so much so that they almost that conservatives have to make it up. Right. President Obama is a communist or a socialist.
Right.
To generate the paranoia or the blowback that was obviously was generated, you know, by at the time back there. So give us a comparison of the political context in which that took place, and then we can talk about why how this stuff is so enduring, I guess.
Well, the political context was very different then, and there was a very wide spectrum. And there were actual communists. I mean, not just people who were called communists, but they were actual communists. Now, in California, in the fields, the labor organizers were mostly communist. They were organizing because nobody else was at the time. The AFL-CIO, the AFL at the time said that only fanatics would organize farm workers because it was so difficult. The farm workers couldn't afford to pay union dues. They were desperately poor. They were very hard to organize because they were from so many different ethnic and racial groups and countries.
Right.
So you had not even a common language. And then they were migratory. You could get them all together, maybe organize. You'd spend all this time and energy to get them together for a union, and then the harvest would be over, and they'd all go to different harvests. And so you'd have to start all over again. And in addition, the growers were very violent in suppressing the strikes, and people died. So it was a dangerous occupation. It was a difficult occupation, and so none of the conventional union organizers would do it. So it was the communists, because of their ideological fervor, who were willing to try to organize these workers. But as a result, of course, then they were easily demonized by the growers as aliens and agitators and genuine Reds.
And so, all right, so let's talk about, I mean, then how do we sort of explain the durability of this type of like rhetoric and response at a time where there is really not that kind of threat to capital in this country?
Well, that is a very good question. And I think it is related to what I said earlier about how the growers were somewhat irrational in their response to New Deal, to the New Deal and to Roosevelt. There is this capital wants to make sure that it can control labor as much as possible. And so any sign that labor is becoming organized and threatening that control over labor costs and thus over profits is very upsetting to the capitalists.
How was this sold and continue to be sold? I mean, on one hand, you know, when we talk about sort of like the Southern strategy and it centering around the idea of race and, you know, different races being a threat. I mean, it is, at least you can see the machinations, right, of how this this plays out, how that's sold to people playing on their racist fears. How was it sold to the public at large? I mean, because presumably, right, the New Deal policies, at the very least amongst American citizens, was fairly popular, wasn't it?
Well, yes. It was sold. It wasn't necessarily bought at the time. But they're developing the selling techniques that they would use and eventually succeed with. But certainly, I mean, Roosevelt in 1936 won the biggest re-election victory since James Monroe ran unopposed in 1820. So he was popular, and then, of course, he went on to win two more terms. So it wasn't that these conservatives were immediately successful. It's that they were developing ideas and strategies that they would then hone eventually begin to succeed with once Roosevelt was dead.
Interesting. Someday I want to read the book about the strategies that didn't work. because God knows what they were, but it does sort of feel there is this sort of like quality, I think, of you know different localities, different places across the country respond with what they know best and try and universalize that sort of, I guess, strategy and hope that it catches fire. I mean, sadly, for many of us, it did in certain instances, but I'd be interested to see the ones that fail.
Well, the big one that failed was the American Liberty League, which was a group of very wealthy people in the Northeast who opposed Roosevelt. And they were, frankly, elitist about their goals and their opposition to the president. And they had a lot of money, but they were not able to get any popular support, and they were gone within a few years, as opposed to the conservatives who were trying out more populist strategies in the 1930s. Those were the ones that would endure, the ones who said, yes, you're benefiting from these economic policies, but think about the cultural threat.
Interesting. Catherine Olmsted, author of Right Out of California, The 1930s and the Big Business Roots of Modern Conservatism. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, we're going to head into the fun half where we're going to get in there quick so I can do a random rush and we've got some sound. Again, you can support this program by becoming a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. We can't do the free show without the support of our members. And if you become a member, I guess it's not free for you because you're a member, but we give you a second show every day. That's at least as long, more often than not. So in a sense, it is free because you're paying for the other show. I don't know. Please don't make me try and figure this out. It's just, we need your support. You can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. We get a little kickback on that. If you buy the Majority Report blend, we get a little kickback on that as well. It's not huge, but it's not nothing. It's great coffee. Go down to your local coffee shop and tell them you should check this out. Get this as your house coffee. Just for the sake of it. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. We skim some of Jeff Bezos's profits off the top. I mean, he's not going to go to the poorhouse after this, but. Nevertheless, majorityreportkickback.com. Quick break. We'll be right back after this.